Hello, everybody. Welcome to the new bonus episodes, or the bonus series, for the second season. I attended the Costa Rican Big Data School, and, you know, I thought that maybe some of you can take some value out of this. You know, many aspiring computer scientists and software engineers would really benefit from the things that they talk about in this event. This was a five-day event from Monday through Friday, from 8 to 4, so it was pretty extensive, and they talked about a lot of different subjects and, you know, very important things that you got to know in this day and age with big data and data science and data analysis. So I thought, you know what? I'll put this up. Maybe some of my listeners can take advantage of this and can benefit from listening to really, really high-end professors from the Texas Advanced Computing Center. So our instructors will be Wei-Ya Xu. He's a PhD and the group lead for Data Mining and Statistics Group. Prior to joining TAC, he obtained a master's degree in biological sciences and a doctoral degree in computer science from the University of Texas at Austin. Then there's also Charlie Day. Charlie Day is the Director of Training and Professional Development with the User Services Group at TAC, with a background in web development and scientific computing. Charlie's responsibilities at TAC include organizing, developing content, and building curriculums for TAC's academic course selection taught in conjunction with several departments at the University of Texas at Austin, as well as for TAC's professional development and educational team. Oh, well. Oh, and just a quick thanks to Danny Xie, who was the one who recorded these segments. Without him, we wouldn't have this awesome bonus round. So thank you very much, and enjoy.
Past experience refers to in the computer science in practice, you work with the data. So you want to learn from the data and be writing a model out. So we talk about what's a testing, what's a training data, what's a pipeline. And then we start to introducing the methods of the machine learning. So first, before we introduce any specific method, the first thing I do is trying to introduce the kind of the higher categories of different machine learning methods. So that starts with things like the supervised learning. So this is the most common method you may find in the machine learning method. It's you start with some type of the training data set and learn with the training data set with the labels, and you learn a model out, and then you use that model to do for future predictions. So I have asked you, or we have discussed the question of under these models for supervised learning, what exactly we are trying to learn here, right? So anyone still remember what we are trying to learn, like, or what supervised learning trying to do, like what exactly is being learned? The predictive variables and how your variables presented in your training data related to the labels you want them to be assessed. So, you know, so in that sense, the supervised learning is now to learn what the underground, what's the actual process to produce the data, produce the labels, but it's trying to mimic the way why a person will assign a label to this data, right? So they have a different hypothesis and different method to model basically the person's behavior, whoever put out the label. So based on what kind of ideas being used behind the machine learning method, there are so many of the different varieties. In these lectures, I want to just introduce several of them, very commonly used method for the supervised learning here. So yesterday we start with the k-nearest neighbor classifications. So the basic idea of the k-nearest neighbor classification is very simple. It's to say we're assuming we have a vector or we have some way of describing our data. Then if we have a way to assess how close a new data to the existing data, then we can base on the non-label of existing data to assess what's the label for the new data should be. Okay? So basically, it's all the data is distributed in a static way in some space. We want to find in its neighbors. Then its neighbor defines which class or which label the barcode told you to name. So we showed a couple of examples. So the idea is very simple. So there's really no algorithm really involved. It's just as long as you have a decent measure, you have a vectors that can describe your data, you can always apply this labor-based classification. There's background data you're describing, you know those labels. Then you have new data, it's just a matter of fact how you can find in the nearest neighbors based on those to decide on them. But the interesting concept that this neighbor can illustrate very well is under all the classification-based methods, there is also this concept of the classification boundaries. It's in an abstract way, all the learning method is trying to learn that boundaries, learn how we can draw a line so we can decide or partition into different regions so we can map in the data into and map in the labels into. So if you change the number of k's, you can see the decision boundaries, it reflects change greatly. Right? If you're only using one neighbors, then it's more in the boundaries, it's more intermixed to each other. If you increase them, you eventually increase makes them more separable. Right? So on the exercise, I have the k-nearest neighbors, and I also have the decision boundaries. So on the graph, you have to run an algorithm. Is there anyone who can try? Yeah, it's working? Okay. Have you tried using different numbers with K or experimenting a little bit? If you haven't got a chance to try and the first time you run notebook, please run the first cell anyway. So the first cell does nothing but just make some plotting functions. So I can easily plot in the rest of the, some of the graph used in the notebook. The plotting function is using MicroLab, and which is another Python libraries. And I think Charlie will do more detailed tutorials on how to use that one. So we can ignore that the first one, but you need to run it once, so all the functions are properly defined. And for the k-nearest neighbor classifications, and the data set we use is a built-in data set. So it has four kinds, and then the data itself is a four-dimensional vectors that with some numerical values. So each one is a flowers, flower petals, lens, wise numbers, that's how the data is. So what this little code does is from the training data set, and we try to fit our training data set into our models. So in this case, there's a k-nearest neighbor classifier implemented in the scikit-learn. You give the number of neighbors you want to use as your k. Then you can put your testing data set in there and to do the predictions. So the first part here is for the training part, and if you want to change the number of neighbors, there is a variable called the n_neighbors. So right now it's using 5, and you can change to basically any numbers you want. Any like public numbers bigger than 0, that would work. Then on the last two lines here, I have that's some made up values here to mimic a new data style. So this is, you can change the number here too, and you can change to whichever number you want and to see what type of prediction it can give to you. So it uses vectors, and it goes through these vectors and then trying to base on, say, if this is actual measurements from certain plans, what that plan should be. So you can give me some predictions, some predictions back. All right, so the next block is a function I use to show the decision boundaries. If you're interested, you can try and you can change, and if you do the different way. Okay. All right, so. Any questions and thoughts about the k-nearest neighbor classifications? Okay. So it's a very simple ideas and a simple measure. So there's potentially a lot of restriction and limitation with the method itself. It's less effective with high-dimensional data, and then the choice of number of neighbors and the choice of the distance functions also matters very greatly for your final accuracies of your models. But this is one type of the kind of the representative method to the instance-based classification method. To overcome some of those limitations, and we can use some other more complex methods to do. So the next type of method I want to introduce is a regression-based method, or based on the linear functions and the linear models. I think we had some lectures from Charlie about the linear algebras, and so regression, so anyone know what regression is, right? Okay, so regression is a simple concept. It's just a statistical method trying to determine the relationships between one dependent variables and one and another, or series of other independent variables of changing values. Right, so the regression method is generally can help us to understand the relationship among your independent variables with your dependent variables, and also helps us to predict values for the unknown target if we know what set of independent variables we want to use. Okay? So there's a concept of the independent variables, and you already said that denoted as x, and the dependent variables denoted as y. And then we have a set of in the typical regression model, the goal is what we are trying to learn is we assuming there is a relationship in some form, I mean, say a linear form, then we can express the y as a linear function of some x, right? Then, but what we don't know is we don't know what exactly the weights of each component or each of weight of or the bias of these particular linear functions. So all the unknown parameters we can call them as theta. This is just an abstract name for it. It can apply to different functions as well. But the goal of the regression model is trying to, here's a set of the training data. We know what's the independent variables, and we know what's the dependent variables, and then let's based on this, let's try to calculate what's the best set of the parameters that can make this fit. Right, so once we know that set of parameters is fit, then we have a set of unknown data with a set of independent variables that we can compute using this function to say what value it is. So that value we can use directly, or we can map them back into a category system to make class labels and create predictions. Right? So that's the ideas. So if you compare the regression model based ideas versus k-nearest neighbors is based on, I want to find you the close neighbor. The close neighbor will define our labels. And here, it's I want to consider like every decision made is the result of consideration of the statistical distribution of the entire data. That all data make contributions to each of each of the single predictions later on, right? Any questions so far? Okay, so the idea is really say, given the set of independent variables, and we're trying to learn the parameter theta, that can set by some functions here. So the common goal of the regression is trying to, so there potentially could be a number of parameters that can make the equation whole in some cases, but not in other cases. We won't expect the parameters can 100% consistent to reflect your training data set. So there are always some inconsistencies. Say if your prediction, your computation will say, I want to use this set of thetas, then maybe 80% of your training data set, you do be able to compute the correct labels, but the rest of them may have a larger margins of errors. So the typical regression method is centered around, like the difference is centered around how they compute the errors and how they try to minimize those errors. Okay. Two commonly used is one is called the ordinary least square method, and the other one called the least absolute deviations of the method there. So those are just one is in the R1 norm and one is RL2 norm of the distance variations. You potentially you can define your own error measures and your own way to do the how the optimization and minimization can happen. So the simplest form of the regression will be just considering two variables, in which case x is really just a series of the singular values. The y will be the outcome variables, and you can get out such data into a two-dimensional space as well. And then if we assuming if we have a linear relationships, and we can easily just using the simplest form of a linear y equals ax plus b, to generalizing that models, then in this case, then the goal of the fit or of the learning is to learn given a set of training data set with these independent variables and dependent variables, what is the best value for A and B. Okay. So that actually should be something people usually learn in the high school, and when you first learn your algebras and then your graph, and we have various by set up the points and what we want to compute is their central tendency or a regression lines out of your data. So that is exactly what this linear regression for, right? So this is an example. I'll say I have one feature x and one target values, and the blue points is to blue points is a long data. So for each given x, I know what the target value it is, and if this is my training data set, the learning of the linear regression we will get is A and B the two parameters, and we can count them at the direct lines in there. Okay, so any questions? No? So the regression line is a simple concept, right? Anybody understand that? So how that one can turn to, say, a category prediction? Say if I have a, if now I know all the blue points is my training data set, right? So here we just have values here. But if I can further divide the blue points into two categories, how the linear regression can help us to make that class label prediction. Yes. Yeah. So that's one way of do the predictions, right? So it's to predict it's on this line or on the other on one side of line or on the other side of line. So if your assumptions are correct, then there might be the case your regression line can separate them into two classes. One is above, one is later. Yes. Why the feature X has value? No intercept, it doesn't really matter. So the A and B, they are just the parameters to define this line. So this line, that maybe only this part, like say minus 1 to 0, is what applicable to your actual problems. But we can calculate the A and the B always, like we will just get a small segment of your regressions. So the message I'm trying to say while I'm asking the question is exactly, this is just a mathematical models for how the labels can correspond to the data. Right? So here, we just assuming a linear function, a linear mathematical function. A line has no end, no start and no ending. And what we do is, as part of modeling a problem, we need to model to think about how the class or how the device, how the different categories can map to this regression line if we're using this such simple assumptions there. Does that answer your question? So that's what I'm trying to ask. But also you can see is linear regression is really very simple and synthesizes a lot of things. So there are other things you can do and also in the real life and in your real world problems, you really won't just have one feature values and you want to compute, and you can have multiple values, and what you do is multinomial linear regressions. So that's same ideas, but you get more kind of zigzag lines that helps you to make the prediction or get what we call the hyperlines in unknown dimensions. You can do that. The other things is the linear regression model can sometimes be overfit to your problems, and it's overly describing based on your training baseline, but lose the generalities and when you want to apply it to other methods as well. So the simple linear regressions. I was just testing this right before the lectures. Anyway, due to the time, I actually removed several slides from today's lectures compared to the yesterday slides, what I intentionally to introduce. So what I'm trying to say is some of the things I removed from slides, I still have the example code there. So one part of code is from the linear regression, you can do multinomial regressions as well. And also the overfit is a commonly concerned with the regression models. So there's a way to introduce in sparsity and the regulations to help to leverage to compensate in that problems. This is actually a training account. Okay. I'll just make sure we can that work.
Thank you for training accounts uploading the tag work. Because the root directory of Anton, it's two cycles. So the VM class has the way.
Anyway, so you can try more different, more complex linear regression method on there. So one of the things I see happening there is called rigid linear regressions, and that one has a paper features and counter the overfitting problem. Okay. So, but those methods are all based on the idea there's a linear form of it, and sometimes we may want to model the not just model the problem as just like linear lines like this. So another very commonly used regression model called logistic regressions. The logistic regressions is the outcome or the dependent variables is a binary. So it's either a 0 or 1 typically. So it does a binary predictions. And then you can take one or more variables as your dependent variables, and it's trying to do compared to the linear regressions. As actually, what she was saying is a linear regression, you are just assuming an infinite number of the spectrums, and here your prediction is actually being capped between the 0 and 1. So how the logic regression can achieve that is the previous example, the linear regression we were showing you is using the form of, say, y equals ax1 plus b, x2, c, x3, and then you can get many of them, but eventually, but at the end, there's still a linear function there. So the logistic regressions trying to model the problem in a standard logistic function way. So here's the functions they're trying to fit. So the function itself is if you take t as a your different variables and as your state data t as output, you see regardless of your input values, it eventually will map them into a 0 to 1 space, right? So if it's varies like in the standard form, say it's in the deep into the negative area, it will be mapped into a 0, and if getting more and more positive, and it will get into the close to the 1. So the matter of the t and how that behaves, how that distributed in along your horizontal axis will affect how this curve performs. So if you are evenly distributed, and you may get seen something like this, and if it's not evenly distributed, and you may get in some more varieties of that. So for the logistic regressions, we want to model the problems. So we still trying to using a linear function to describing all those independent variables. But here the need is so we can test for this type of, so basically for here what we are trying to learn is for the observed independent variables, how that maps to one of the values of t here. So you have a standard logistic functions like this, and then we can assume the variable here is take a linear form of your independent variables x. Then the final functions we're putting them together, we're trying to optimize or trying to learn is this set of parameters help us to define t, help us to define the final prediction value. Okay. Is that clear to you or any questions about what's the parameters actually being learned in logistic regressions? Okay. Let me see if there's one back in here. Okay, so if yours working well and you can try it, and so I want to just quickly go through some outlines in the writing code to help you understand a little bit better. So scikit-learn has linear models, and in there's a set of the regression method, linear method being implemented. Linear regression is a very simple one. It's one of them. So in my first examples, and what I'm trying to do is I just generating some random generating the data. So I have 100 samples, and I have a certain bias, certain noise, and then I can generate them as a training data set. I hope it's pretty good. So when it's running. For this one, should be okay. Anyway, we can come back to that. So I need to go back to my slides here. So what I was trying to show is I have several examples, and it's generating different graph as well. So you can change the parameters and try to see how those affect that can help you to understand the slides a little bit better. So I purposely removed some of the slides. So I want to have more time so you can have a, you can experiment in them on your own. When it's come back, then I can walk through them again. So linear regression, is one of the commonly used methods, but it's very simple. It has the simple suggestions, simple assumptions about how the models, about the models. The logistic regression is equally used very commonly because the properties is maps your output into 0 and 1 for you to easily to assess a kernel probability and to map to it. So you can use it directly to do a 0, 1 binary classifications, or you can use it as a probability-based predictors and to predict what's a what's the likelihood for your data to became belong to one for one of the class or not. Okay. So both of them are very useful and very easy to run, and they do not have a lot of computational requirement. And you can see it goes through your data once. It's a linear complexities. So that's all the nice properties with the linear and logistic regression based method. But among all the linear method based ideas, one of the most popular and used very commonly for the classification of supervised learning is called support vector machines. Have you heard about this method before? Support vector machines? Okay. So for those of you who are not really familiar with it, so it's a, what we call the discriminative classifiers. And if you give a set of the label the training data set, it's trying to learn a actual hyperplanes that trying to separate in your data into different areas or categories and in a certain vector space. Okay. So again, I have a simple example here. It's a, let's consider a simple data distributions. So in this case, our data only have two dimensions, x and y. So there's a, so you have a two independent variables. Then, given x, y, we can plot them in a two-dimensional space like this. Then you see now I also cover my points with right and blue to correspond to different paths in which it belongs to. Right? So there are, say, 20 data points, and each data points has two-dimensional values on x and on y, and then their labels is reflected by the colors of each dot it takes. Okay? So in this case, the goal of the support vector machines is trying to find a linear separator that can separate these two classes. But just by looking at this photos, this image, we can easily see where that linear separator should be, right? It should be here, like going this way, or going this way. It's more should be going this way, right? So it's a go from here, and if we have a line in between here, we can separate in the space nicely to be say, hey, this part is the red class, and this part is blue class, right? So that's the sort of the ideas of the support vector machine-based classifiers. So we want to identify or draw a linear separator like this. So how the names coming for this method is how this line, so there potentially could be a number of ways we can draw this line just even within this blank space here. So the name of support vectors is referring to the set of vectors on each side of the line that are closest to this boundaries you are trying to define. So the goal of the algorithm itself is not just randomly draw lines, but mathematically trying to determine what would be the most optimal the lines we should draw in this space here. In a mathematical form, so we are trying to maximize the margins between the vectors closest to these lines on each side. So that side is that we are trying to put the lines right in the middle of, so it is not too close to the red class or not too close to the blue class yet. Okay? So now if you think about the name, the support vectors, it's really your hyperplane here, the linear separators, is defined by the set of vectors close to these boundary conditions. Okay? Any questions about these ideas? Or so suppose we can, through the mathematical method, and we can do these computations, and we can find that optimal line, then the classification with support vector machines that became fairly easy. It's what we already do is through the learning process, and we will learn weight matrices to define that hyperplane and to define the line. So once we have that one, given a new point, and we just need to compute which side of this viewpoint that stays, and to assign a class label to that new data point here. Any thoughts or about this method, or any questions, any confusions? It sounds very simple, right? Nothing more than the linear regression lines, but just here we have two paths, and we want to not assuming a form yet, but kinds of mathematical ways for to decide that. So I skipped the mathematical details slides from here and these exist in my yesterday's lectures, but just in time. I'm not going to talk about more of that. But for a time, the support vector machine has been very successful and being used in a lot of fields for different applications as well. But just from what I have been showing you so far, do you have any concern about this method when it may not be a good fit, or you see, like all these methods we talked about so far about regression methods, they all based on there is somewhat of a linear function to supporting them, a linear model in the back to try to support them. So what if in this case my data right on blue is nicely seted into a linear cyclical space? What if that's not the case? Right, so will we still be able to use the regression-based method or SVM here? So anyone see what I'm trying to ask you? So for example, you know, previously, what I show is, if I just show this part, and it may seem these two red dots and these three blue dots can be easily intersected by a separator sphere. But if we actually see the entire picture, and they may actually to be the red dot is within in some of the blue dots. And then in that case, we actually maybe need a circle or something nonlinear trying to define our boundaries, right? So this is actually maps to a lot of the practical applications. That's where it's needed. So that is a direct kind of the counter examples for where the linear regression method or linear place method in general can be fit into it. So now, why the SVM can be very useful or very successful. So if you do a research, maybe Google search or iterative search, you will find that from 2000 to 2010, there's a lot of machine learning-based method or application that using support vector machines. The reason is the support vector machine method is a method that really overcome that linear separation constraints by introducing what they call the kernel functions. So here, the kernel functions is a function that basically transforming your data. So your data, if you draw them in a two-dimensional space, maybe like this, but if we do not assuming them as a two-dimensional space, but assuming them as a three-dimensional space, and do a projection to that three-dimensional space, if we are clever enough, we actually can do a projection like this. So in this case, if you look at your...
So the two-dimensional view will become a view to look at from this place.
So the kernel function is what support vector machine introduced as the features. There are three built-in functions, the linear, the radius, and the Gaussian functions that help you to mapping your data from the original space into a other space that might become more linear separables. So because of those kernel functions, and it makes linear method-based functions became like very suitable and very nicely fit to a lot of the practical problems there. So let me go back. So I'm not going to try and run this right now, but I still want to show you the code I have. So for the linear regressions, the first part is I did a sample, so you can see how things being distributed. And then the rest of them, I use another data set from the scikit-learn. It's a part of scikit-learn called the breast cancer data set. So where you can assess based on certain data whether this is a really cancerous, a real tumors, or just a benign tumors. Then I have some example for the reach regression method and for the logistic regression method and for the support vector machine here. I think they're all using the same breast cancer data set. So what I'm suggesting is that you can run all of them if you can, and to see from distributions, and then to see how different methods may have a different accuracies. For this data set, it's a very good example of data set, so you may not see there's a lot of difference between them. For the support vector machines, the first several cells are using the linear kernels. So basically, you're still mapping them into you just assume the data. It comes as a linear separables. And then the next couple of them is using the different kernels. The next two using the VDS-based kernels. And then we have the polynomial or Gaussian-based based on kernels being built in there. Okay, so anyone can run the meter notebook separately from CrypCloud? Yes, you can. Okay, you're lucky. I think Charlie trying to contact with the company without what the issue is. I think I have tried my own account, it seems the same thing. Let me just continue with my lecture. I'm trying to do that on the slide. I'm trying to do it generally. So far we talked about two types of ideas. One is an instant-based classifier, and the other one is based on linear models. So for the linear models, we assume some type of linear functions can describe the relationships between our input data and the outcome we're trying to predict. So the next set of ideas I'm trying to introduce is not based on the linear model, but based on the statistical distributions. So in this type of the classifier, what we're trying to assume is now to say our observe the data has certain linear relationship with our outcomes or our independent variables, but they satisfy some kind of prediction. They are all coming from a certain statistical distributions. Is there questions?
I had a question for the vector models. You can give some examples where they can be applied in
for the support vector machines?
Yeah.
That's what I was trying to show from the Jupyter notebooks. So in the Jupyter notebooks, we use the breast cancer data set. So that data set has 70 some like vectors to describe the symptoms. So it's basically an image. I think it originally is an image data that transformed into a vectors. And then they have labels to say this is a good tumor, this is a bad tumor, good tumors, bad tumors. Then the practice I have here is actually trying to say if we have some historical experience with for this patient and for this set of data, the doctor says it's a good tumor, so it's a benign tumor. For this, it's a real cancer. Then if we have a new patient comes in, and if we have this set of data, whether we can make the prediction of that. Okay? So I have been using that example for a lot of the supervised learning methods here. Would that be good enough for you as an example, or you were asking something else?
All right.
I don't know how you make images.
Your question is more on how your real, your home data can be bring in and used for this purpose, right? So that's what we have Charlie here for. Like, to remember, the Charlie has been giving tutorials on Python. Say yesterday we have Pandas lectures, and if we have if your data is saved in a CSV file, you can easily reason in as a Panda data frame, and from Panda data frames, and you can convert them into a vectors and then use that vectors here as to do the changes. So even this set of data, and you can easily, if you have your own data, and then it's just a matter to read that files in as a data frame. Select the data or design assign the which one is the labels and making them suitable here. Okay. If someone is interested, maybe we can run some in the afternoon if the things is working. Okay. So one of the things I'm trying to do here is now trying to already focus on a particular method, how it can be applied. The second learn, as you can see, is similar as a pipeline concept. All of those things, if you look at them closely, they are actually in a very similar form of the coding. And they always start with, we get this data, and we split the data into testing and the training data set. Then we know which label it is, and then we create different classifiers, and then we just put our training data set into that classifiers, right? So here, I have the initial training data set that can be split. So because I'm needing a function, a building data set, so I can just use this to do a random split to split them into two parts. One part is training, one part is testing. Then I give my training and the data. This is my training feature vectors, and this is my training labels. And whatever the classifier I want to use, I want to the classifier be able to fit inside my training data set. Then the result, I can use that result for the future testing and future predictions. Okay, so as you can see, all of those classifiers basically take the same similar set of the interface, right? So once you can read your data in, and you can just throw the rest of them to testing and try with your data. Yes.
We were discussing before how to train with outliers.
Okay. So do you want to detect outliers, or do you want to reduce their effect when you do the classifications? So that's a kind of the two different things for outlier detection versus get rid of noise. There's a number of ways we can do to reduce noise and reduce outliers. Those are not particularly matched to one of the supervised learning methods. It's more belongs to the unsupervised learning method, which I will introduce later in the lectures I need to handle them. For the supervised learning, now I want to code the question I'm trying to ask you. Nobody really responds to me is what exactly the supervised learning trying to learn, right? So it's learn the relationships between labels and observed data. And to detecting outliers or get rid of that effect is actually a learning toward the data structures, what type of, like what structures within your data. So that's what the unsupervised learning method can do. You will see it will make more sense once we introduce more method there. So any other questions for the existing method?
How do you know the entire population between A and B?
You don't. So again, for the supervised learning, just remember that what you are trying to learn is how or why the label has been assigned to this data, right? Has nothing to do with how the data should be labeled this way or not to be labeled, whether there's a physical process to produce that or not to produce that. So in a way, what we do, the supervised learning is not to learn how the physics or nature behaves, but more on whoever made the first round of curation of your data why the main is the data that way, right? So it's trying to think of that one. Then if you have that in mind, you will understand it's actually doesn't matter which method you want to try to apply to it. It's the method is based on assumption you want to produce the what kind of relationships and how we can describe the person label the data in a more mathematical precise form. Okay. So when I say people labels data, that equally applies to if your labels comes from elsewhere. The supervised learning is always just trying to give you an explanation why this data being labeled this way. So you never know, there's never guarantee to say that it's picked from linear label algorithm or linear similar. You just assume this thing might be approximated by linear models, where this thing might be approximated by statistical models. So I want to try that, I want to use it. So you don't know when you try something, but if you try SVM, you try the UBS classifier, the UBS classifier performs much better than some provider machine, then you know your data is not very friendly with linear method. So that's how you know. But there's really no say before you try that, no kind of physical thing to travel to say you absolutely cannot try this method with your problem. Any other questions? So that's another reason is instead of going details into one method, what I want to do is to give you a quick view of what's the common ideas and common models out there for you to run as a supervised learning method. Okay. So the next big group of the classification method is this statistic-based method. So one of the most popular ones is naive Bayes classifier. So the basic idea is to treat the data and its label as some kind of the statistical parsers. From historical data, what we still estimate the parameters, but the parameters is not weights for the linear function, but it's the parameters for your statistical distributions. Right? Say, even you have a simple Gaussian distribution, you have the mean, the variance and the central expectations and those kind of the statistical parameters is what the statistical based method is trying to learn. So back to the naive Bayes classifiers, the idea, this is one of the simplest one for the statistical based classifiers, but it's also a very commonly used, very easily to be applied. It's based on the idea of the Bayes theorem. It takes very similar form as the joint probabilities. So in this case, so what I'm showing here, you can see if you're more from statistical background, you can certainly see there's a joint probabilities on the probability we observe both A and B, then equals the probability given B, we observe A multiplied by the probability after we observe B, right? So probability of observe both A and B are the same whether you observe A first and then observe B or observe B first and then observe A. So that's where the Bayes theorems trying to describe. But when we try to apply these equations from the joint probability perspective to an inference perspectives, we sort of assign the different meanings to each of the symbols, right? So if I'm going too quickly, so remember here I'm just using A and B. You pretty much can ignore the I here, right? So I just representing the entire space you're concerned about. So just considering A and B, and in the next slides, I actually change them into H and D here, right? So that reflects the meanings of the change or the perspective being changing from the probability science to the inference side. So here we want to use H to stand for the hypothesis. So that's a hypothesis for the classifier would be this particular data in certain class, in this class, or in another class. Then D here is representing the data. So now, what we already call is on the left hand of the equation is your posterior probability of, say, if we observe this set of D, this set of data, that observations, what's the probability we can assign to for this hypothesis being true. So again, the hypothesis could be the data is from class A or class B. So that's a goal, that's the one we want to be able to ultimately assess. Then on the right hand of the equations, then you can see there's three components. So the probability of age is we call the prior probability. So that's without the data and what's the probabilities we think the hypothesis should be true. So that's kind of like if without any knowledge, what's our best guess about which class it could be, right? So if you think of flip the coin, then that probability maybe say without any other evidence or without other thing for us to say, then the prior probability for heads up or heads down will be equally be 50%, right? So that's a prior, that's what we call the prior probability without any data presence. Then we have another term of the likelihood of B given H. So this is a kind of the probability of given B was probability of A given B. So this is to say if we know this hypothesis is true, like say if we know the height is up and how likely we are observing a particular set of data belong to that class. Then the last one is called the evidence of the of given I. So again, the I here, you pretty much can ignore. So this is just the probability of your observing this set of data in general. And it was in all cases, regardless of your hypothesis is true or false, right? Okay. Any questions about this transformation? So we did a, so from the joint probabilities, we're trying to re-describing them as an inference. So what we are trying to inference is we now, for the classifier task, we are trying to make them as an assessment of the likelihood or the probability of which hypothesis are most likely to be held true. Now the question is how we can mathematically sort of define this and compute this. So in the practice, what the Bayes classifier turns to is we know our data usually constitute of multiple attributes and multiple variables or parameters, or any way you want to call them. So now our data can be seen as a set of the variables. So that was our D, and then C was our class. So now the D became this set of variables. Then we want to choose the value of the, so if we can, for the given set of data, and we can calculate in this posterior probability for each of a given class, then we can choose a value that gives us, and choose a class that gives us the maximum value of the maximum posterior probabilities values here. So at the end, for the naive Bayes classifiers, at the end, what we are end up is we're trying to estimate is say, given each class, if it's to be true, what's the likelihood for us to observe this set of data. So that's to further simplify the computation of these terms. What we want to do is introducing the naive Bayes assumption, where we want to assuming for all the attributes we have on our data set, we are independently distributed. So we can further expanding this term, given a particular class hypothesis, the joint probability of observing those set of attributes to be a multiplier of given this set of the class. What's the probability of observing each of those attributes? Okay. You still follow so far? So I know this may be a little bit confusing. So let's look at a quick examples on how this being applied. So what you are seeing here is a simple testing data tables. For this testing data tables, it only have a really like the three attributes. The first one is ID, so we can ignore those. There's 10 data points, three attributes. So the first, so the table is about tax return. I don't know if you do that same here, but in the United States, we get our salaries and the government will hold some a portion of it as tax. Then each year you need to file this tax return form and to say here's the tax you should collect from you. If you collect, if you hold more than you should collect, then the government will refund out some monies. Or some cases they hold less than what you should pay, then we need to pay more monies. Right? Is that a similar process here or completely different? Completely different. You don't pay tax? Okay. Yeah, anyway, so that's a process here. So what this table is trying to simplify is we have a government branch called the IRS, and each year they are responsible for getting all the people's data, people's filing, and trying to assess whether there are some people being dishonest in their tax return, and they want to get more refund, or they should pay, but they want to get, they want to get refund instead, just get more money out of government. So the real data, we will have hundreds of the attributes associated to it, because they really, whenever you file a tax return, it constitutes a lot of data in there. So what this small data table trying to do is to simplify that. So the first column of refund, you see the value is yes and no. Basically, that's a request to say for this filing, for this person, whether he wants to request a refund or not to request a refund. Right, so if yes, is this file is about to request a refund. Then the second column is about the marital status of the persons. So you see it's a single, married, divorce. It's three different values. And then the third one is the taxable income. So that's basically the annual salary of that person. Okay? Then the last line, the last column is kind of labels. So this is historical data. So somehow the IRS can verify, oh, the first one is not a cheater, and it does need a refund. So that's no, and then yes, it means this is maybe a suspicious tax filing, and we may need to do further investigation on that. Okay. So this is type of algorithm, is something, or this type of task is actually something the IRS actually use, so they do use computational based method, trying to help them to filtering out a subset of people they want to maybe, how people don't need to afford the tool. So in this case, we essentially, our goal is to say given, say, three attributes, right? The refund, marital status, and the taxable income. We want to make a inference on whether there's a potential suspicious tax evasion happens here, right? So for the class, we have a two class. So one is a yes class, it is tax evasion, and a no class. This is not tax evasion. So recall for the probability, the three terms. So one of them will be the probability of the of each class, how they distribute it, right? So in this case, so for the no class, there's a 7 out of 10 no's. So we can assess the prior probability of that being 0.7. Then for the yes class, for the other class, there's a 3 out of 10 yes. So we can assess the prior probability of at the 0.3. So in another way, just from this data, what we can say is maybe in general, there's a 30% of people trying to cheat the government and getting more money out. So that's kind of the statistical view without adjustment of actual data. Okay, so we have a prior probability of the prior class probabilities. Now we want to assess its prior attribute probabilities. So for given each class, what's the probability we observe each distinct values in there, right? So for something like a categorical value, it seems fairly straightforward. Like here I showed a couple of examples. So if we talk about the marriage status column, like second one, we want to see what's the attribute probability of married people filing versus others, and we can count there's four filings with from married couples. So that attribute probability for that column became 4 out of 7. So that's So how the idea is here. So your initial training data set will help you to calculating that statistical distribution parameters out. Okay. So far we talked about class probabilities. The other two columns and the class probabilities, they all are from the categorical values. So we can do the probability calculation just simply by the fractions of each value's presence. What about the refund? What about the taxable income columns? So that's because it's a more like a continuous variables, right? So in this case, we do not want to break them. We could break them into categories to say here's people earns more than $100,000 a year. Here's people more than under $20,000 a year. Here's people something like that. But in a better way, so we can model that as a sum of the distributions. So that is a more commonly being used with the statistical attributions. The learning process is also a part of the process and trying to learn how those prior attributes probability distributed. So suppose in this case, we want to assume a normal distribution for the people's salaries. And then based on the set of data, and we can calculate sample mean, sample variance, and then go back and to identify the statistical parameters that we can infer from this the taxable income columns and for each of the class. So for the class no, we can calculate sample mean, sample variance, and for the class yes, we can again calculate the sample mean and the sample variance. So that is to say, for the different class, we can calculate a different set of parameters, even assuming they are all follow the same normal distributions. Okay. So once we have all those prior class probability being calculated from the training data set, and we have the prior attributes probability calculating from the training data set, and given a new record, we just pop that one back to the parameters we calculate based on the training data side, and we can do those calculations for each of the class. So we first do the class for the no class, we get in value, and then we do for the yes class, we get in value, then we view based on which one is bigger, so that has a maximum value, and we choose the class label to give it onto that class. Okay, so that's kind of the general flow of naive Bayes classifiers. So it's assuming your observation and the labels follow some type of the statistical process. So now the goal for the learning models is to learn what exactly describing that statistical process here. So for the naive Bayes classifier, we treat them as a joint statistical distribution of all your attributes with regard of each individual class. Then for the assessment, for the inference part, once we have the parameter for each of the class, we just calculate that values for each class and to choose the one with the maximum value. All right, sounds simple or straightforward? Any questions? Yes?
You said that this model assumes data are independent.
Yes.
How robust it is when you have data that are dependent, let's say, temperature and some other thing? That
Yes, that's a very good question. So that's a very good catch. So naive Bayes classifier is something you can always find and always use. You will never know whether, basically there's no guarantee to say all the attributes are independent to each other. So again, this is the assumption you have to it. The more, if your data, the column is more correlated to each other, it will certainly have an effect on the naive Bayes classifier hypothesis. Because those columns basically add up and will make your classifier biased to whichever the dominant reason to make those columns are correlated at the first place. Does that make sense? So the answer to your question, the first part is you still can use them. Once they are not even distributed, there is potentially a big accuracy effect on the naive Bayes classifier. And thirdly, how we can deal with it. So we can deal with it in two ways, right? So one is we can run pre-processing, and then we can select the component that more nice correlated, like more orthogonal to each other, and then we can use those components for the naive-based classifier. So again, that's something I will cover in the unsupervised learning method. And then the other way, so the statistical classifier is a huge class of the classifier method. So there's a number of different methods out there. There are other methods like naive AS9 that can deal with some of the correlations among your attributes as well. So that's another method you could try if you feel there's a strong correlations among your data points. Aside of the Bayes-9, there are also the method called hierarchical Bayes classifications, where you can try to assess different distribution, different model for the subset of your data and the subset of your attributes in a more hierarchical ways to make the statistical-based method still fast. So two ways, one is trying to get rid of the correlations, and the other way is finding more complex and other methods that may be able to help you handle those correlations. Very good, so, yes?
I have a question with the taxes income. What happens with the variable is continue?
Right, so that's what we do here, right? So taxes for we want to model them as a normal distribution, so we do treat them as a continuous variables here.
Do you change the variable?
No, so what we do here is we assuming each column is coming from a statistical process, right? So the statistical process can generating discrete variables or can generating continuous variables. And for the statistical process generating discrete variable like categorical, we can do simple as fraction of the observation, so that's done. And for the columns that generating continuous variables like this, we can further assuming a distribution that that columns follows. So in this case, we assuming the tax income for those normal distributions. So now we have these observed values in there, and we have an underlying normal distribution there. Right, so we take those data we have as a sample points. Now the task is from the sample data, go back and to estimate your population parameters for that distribution. So from here to here, what we did is we evaluating for each class and for those set of samples, and we are going to, so this is a formula for the normal distributions. And what we want to assess is the sample mean and sample variance that we can estimate based on the samples, and then we can use that to infer what the population mean and population variance that will give us these parameters for the underlying distribution, right? So we do treat the taxable income as continuous variable, and we treat the discrete data set we see from the training data set as the samples of that continuous distribution. Then we use it to estimate the statistical parameters that can generate in there. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So now you see, like, when we have a new data point we are trying to do the assessment, we actually pull them back into our statistical distribution to calculate what's the probability for us to observe this value under different statistical distributions as well. Any other questions? Okay. So I think this is the last group of the classifier I want to introduce. It's called the decision tree-based classifiers. It's also sometimes in machine being referred as a symbolic computing classifiers. The reason is they perform in a quite different ideas and different ways, right? So so far we have a linear method-based classifier, we have statistical-based classifier, we have instance-based classifier. So they will dividing them based on some sort of the decent space or statistical space. So what that means is if you recall the regression line or the boundaries I'm showing you, it will try to divide it based on your data points. Where assuming your data exists in some type of space, what the method does is trying to, based on the training data set, and to cut those data space into different area. So then they want to assign where your data fall into a size of one. So in general, the decision tree-based classifier is not trying to divide in that data space, but they are trying to make a division along your feature space, okay? So it's a two different concept. The data space is like when we're plotting them, you see a X, Y, you see a scatter plot here. But in the decision trees, they are actually more act on your feature space. You have these many features. I want to cut them into different parts, and I want to see how those parts affect my final labels. Okay? So decision tree-based classifier is also one of the earliest classifier method being proposed. It still works very effective today. The idea of that, this is the same data tables I showed previously, in the previous statistic. The idea is to treat each of the attributes as some type of the statistical distribution, and through the training data we can learn, we can infer those parameters to behind those statistical distributions. For the decision tree-based algorithms, we don't really care about that. What we want to do is, now we see all of this, we want to make a type of tree structures can help us to make decisions. So this is, again, this is one of the earliest methods. So this is one that actually more closer to mimic how people will make decisions, right? So for example, I'm a tax inspector, so I look at the data. Without any computational help, I may have a certain preference. So based on my experience, maybe I want to look at the refund first. Based on my past experience, nobody requesting refund has been trying to do the tax evasion. So I will automatically filter those out, then focus on the people now requesting refund, right? So then do further investigation. So this is the output of the model of the decision tree is really like a decision tree, how people may make decision tree by looking at one column at a time, then move on to the next column, then move on to the next columns. So algorithmically, this is just one of the algorithms can help you to do that. It's we want to give in this set of data, and we can take one attribute out, and then we can split based on the values of the what values presented for that attribute, and split the data set into two parts. So in this case, in these examples, we start with the first column, refund columns. Then we notice there's two different values, a yes value and no values. And then we can split the second layer. We can have two children for this no. And then on the left is a yes pass. On the left is who requesting refund. So that's essentially the ID 1, ID 4. And ID 7, so we only have these three data points belong to the left branch, and then we have the rest of 7 belong to the right branch, okay? Then we can look at the class labels. Now we notice, and then for the left branch, for people requesting refund, none of them has been found with the tax evasion yet, so they are all from the no cheating class, so there's no meaning for us to splitting that one further because all the data from this class share the exactly same labels. Okay? Now we look at the right branch. We realize there are mixing between some data has this label, some data has that label. So there's a mixing of data label. So we can pick another attribute. So in this case, it's our second attribute columns, and we can do a further split to split our data set here. And so on. So eventually, what we want to do is we want to generate a tree at its leaf node being there's no more children of that node. All the data constituted that node is all from one specific class, doesn't have a mix. So then for new data points, we can simply go through this tree and based on their splitting conditions, and then to see where we are end up with, and then whichever we end up with, that label to that node will become the label for the new data we're trying to assess. Okay? Any questions about this process? So we start all the 10 data as one set, then we find there's a different labels, then we pick one attribute to do a split, and then to see for the after the subset and which one has more mixed labels, then we pick again, and then we do the split. Okay. Any questions? Okay. So then I have a question for you to think is, does it matter which the order of the attributes I pick? It is? Why?
Because some might be able to discriminate data better than others.
Yes, that's correct, but will it affect the final result? So in this case, I sort of pick the refine first, then marriage status next, then taxable income. What if we pick the say taxable income first, then pick marriage status, then pick refund? Will that give for the same unknown data when we're trying to? So if we pick a different order, then the tree will look different, right? Right. But if for the same new data points, will the two different tree give you different classification result? Or give you the same classification results?
Yes, but the tree will be larger.
Yes, so you're right. So it's the ordering of picking the columns or how you splitting the attributes will generate different decision tree. But if all tree will end up with each node from one single class, then they all can give you the same result. When you apply 20 data points. But the difference would be some tree might be more efficient and some tree may be less efficient, they are much bigger and some is much less, right? So that's the ideal case where we can do that final split. And in the practice, it's not only just matter of efficiency, I mean, there's might be a lot of cases where it's very hard to end up with one node is uniform class label. So that's where there's actually the idea is simple from attributes to get a precise way. But the iPhone recommendation is how you can achieve that. It's actually there's a number of different algorithms trying to do and trying to give you what we call optimize the tree structures. Okay? So just one quickly, one of the principles they are trying to use in terms of doing the splitting attributes, splitting values, is we can use some type of the quantitative measures and to measure the information content within that node before we do the splitting. Then we can try out a different way including five different attributes, and for the same attributes and the different categories or bracket we want to split in the then for all of them, we can assess the same type of the quantitative numerical metric, and then we can assess if we do this split, how much we can gain from this particular split. Then we're going to choose the one with give us a maximum gain. Okay? So that's sort of general principle here. So we're finding some numerical metric helps us quantify what we are being gained, what we can gain from each individual split. So again, that's where the different decision tree-based algorithms are different from each other. There's a multiple metrics you could choose. So some commonly used one is like information entropy. It's one of the most commonly used one. But there are other metrics, different methods can use and how we can use the tree speed. So I'm going to finish that slide here with a break.
Okay.
All right.
We're going to kill the containers. Okay. Running the training in-house, and then we're going to
restart.
So when we begin the next sessions, so I'm almost done with my supervised learning method here. So just a quick summary about decision tree based classification. It's a very good method. It's act on a completely different ideas with the previous one. So this one, dividing the classification boundaries along your feature space rather than your data space. So that's a very different from the previous one. So which means if you try some vector machine doesn't work, you test the test space method doesn't work, the decision tree based method may work because they act on completely different approach. Okay. It's very quick to construct decision tree and very quick to do the inference as well. It's less effective if there's a lot of noise, a lot of anomaly there. So it's an effect to you for you to work hard to get off the node points only contain a single class. So in the reality is you also end up with some type of percentage of impurities in your node, in your final node layers. So if you like this type of method, what the people actually using nowadays, exactly on this method, is another method called random forest. So the name, like in computer science, we call all those tree structures the trees. If you have a lot of trees, then they became a forest, right? So the random forest method is exactly like that. So if one there's a limitation with using one decision trees, how about that's building thousands of them out of same data side? So the random forest act on that ideas, but they are not building the decision tree, the thousand decision tree on exactly the same set of data. So for each time they random pick a subset of data and a subset of the attributes they want to use to build the decision tree. So each of the trees will be built on completely different subset. So there might be some implications, but mostly they are going to be different. So the idea is that can also be a way to counter the correlations among the attributes or redundancy among your subset data. So the idea is if some tree is heavily biased to certain things, but we trust the statistically, not all the trees will do that, right? So when we do the inference, we will ask all the trees to do the inference at the same time. Then later we will collect the results and make those and to decide which one we should choose by choosing say majority of the class labels here. So this method is very useful and very accurate and very applicable. It doesn't affect being affected much by the high dimensionalities. On the other hand, it's a very good fit, a very good matching method for the big data analysis. Because here, regardless how big your data it is, the idea of this is to build a number of trees. Each of the trees are independent with each other. So you can build them independently using different subsets, and we'll do the inference. We can do all the things in parallel and in a distributed way as well. So the whole process is actually very similar, very consistent with the MapReduce or RDB type of approach there. So for a lot of the big data analysis classifications, so this is actually a very documented in practice. Okay, so this is just pretty summarizing what I said about the one page and this one page with random forest. So let's take a break. So we are going to restart all the containers, and after we come back, and we may be able to try them again. And then I have a few more slides about unsupervised learning. After I've done that, I have another slide time. We'll do some quick introduction about the deep learning method as well. Okay? So it's coffee time.